Welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body, a podcast from the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. I'm Dr. Saul Rosenthal, a health psychologist in the Boston area, and your host as we investigate the incredible connections between brain and body. Our guide today is Mayla Berger, a holistic health practitioner and expert in body-based therapeutic approaches, including the Rolf method of structural integration, wellness coaching, and emotional balancing. Mayla is also the founder and director of the International Institute of Healing and Cultural Arts, which is focused on training neurosomatic integration to practitioners who are part of the BIPOC community, practitioners who are Black, Indigenous, and people of color, a community that has been underserved by the healthcare system, at least in the United States, and underrepresented as healthcare providers. On May 2nd, she's presenting a webinar to the NRBS focused on making culturally conscious and ethical connections for BIPOC empowerment. We talked about historical biases that continue to harm members of the BIPOC community and how we, as healthcare providers, can work to connect more effectively with our patients. Mayla, welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body.
Thank you.
You were giving a webinar on the May the 2nd focused on culturally conscious and ethical engagement with BIPOC communities. I'd like to start with something that's probably pretty basic, which is, what do you mean by culturally conscious?
Essentially, to be familiar with the culture that you are working with, to have a deep understanding, because you're dealing with deep issues, so that it becomes important to understand the culture in relation to the different types of trauma, in particularly relational trauma, cultural trauma. What are the traumas that are peculiar to this population? And we also have to recognize and give credence to the fact that we live in parallel realities, that the reality that you live in is not the reality that the BIPOC community lives in. And it becomes important to appreciate that, to be able to approach an empathetic relationship with the community you're working in. I think it's necessary to demonstrate your consciousness to be able to evoke trust and safety, which are primary in the relationship. It helps to be able to have to connect with that self energy, so that your client can feel your sincerity and not have a superficial engagement with you, knowing that you are not them, but you understand and are not judging. You know, that will make safety.
So you're saying that to try to build that strong connection with clients, you may not be part of the same cultural background as them, but you at least need to have a deeper understanding of it.
Yes. That you have made the effort to know the person you're speaking to. Mm-hmm. So that the person you're speaking to doesn't have to explain themselves to you, that you have an understanding of their challenges. Maybe not all, but enough to be able to evoke safety and comfort and trust, to be able to convey that I'm not looking at you through my assumptions, that I'm looking at you and receiving you, and that I have made an effort to know you and what you're dealing with.
I guess one of the things that occurs to me when I struggle with this issue is, how do I do that? I mean, and I know that sounds perhaps naive, and probably even is, but when I think about even the range of different cultures of the clients that I've worked with, and it's probably more narrow than many other clinicians,
how do I actually become and take a deep dive into the cultures of so many people that I work with, where culture even, you know, when I work here in Boston, culturally even seems to differ from neighborhood to neighborhood.
I mean, there's different levels, and it's interesting. First off, some of the things that are being shunned in the American culture right now are actually a good pathway to understanding that if we look at racialized trauma, for one, there are things that we have in common if you've been racially traumatized. Be you BIPOC, be you Jewish, be you whatever. Trauma, just being able to connect and empathize with the experience of being traumatized by your environment, okay? Knowing the history, which there's a great effort to keep you from knowing the history. And I'm suggesting that it's essential for you to know the history so that you can know the institutions that were set up to create some of the challenges for the people that you're working with, ways to do that. Well, there's the 1619 Project, you know, which is really interesting reading if you bother. There's a book to read. I also suggest stepping into some, on YouTube, you have access to many different conversations so that, for instance, there's a talk show, Roland Martin, who is a Black journalist. And it's not like I enjoy all of his presentations, but it's a good depiction of Black intellectuals having conversations with each other without code switching. So there's an opportunity for you to have a genuine experience of a BIPOC community. Movies, just going out of your way to seek current events, current issues of the population that you're seeking to deal with. I work with returning citizens, people who have been released from prison. Fortunately, I have never been to prison. But there are ways for me to get an inkling of what that experience is. And I do research on it. I have a client who was forced to be a sex worker to be able to support herself in this economy. And I've done research on sex work because in myself, it's like, oh, that's prostitution. But to open up enough to understand that world and confront my desire to judge. My first thought is judge. And as I do more research, that judgment softens. It's not that I still want her to do it, but it doesn't have the same charge. And I have the space to have more understanding so she doesn't feel judged. Because if I do judge her, she shuts down. That's that.
Well, as clinicians, that is a goal to go into a situation non-judgmentally. And I think what you're suggesting is we need to understand, we need to have some understanding of that person and their experience, even if we haven't necessarily shared it. In order to do good work, in order to do, well, ethical, I think you use the word ethical in your title, to do good and ethical work.
Well, we're all bound by do no harm. And it takes work to do no harm. And in the case of dealing with a population that is not yours, you have to obligate yourself to do research into that population, to be humble, to be able to listen And that brings me to the other big thing is be able to look at yourself and your implicit biases. Mm-hmm. You have to do your own work to be able to create a safe space for people that that are not in your sphere. And I have to say that I am BIPOC and I deal with the community. And in these times, I'm dealing with people who were growing up in the 80s in New York. And the majority of them were victims of the crack epidemic. And I deal with trauma. So we're dealing with just unconscionable situations. And I have to do a lot of work to stay open and not be triggered and deal with myself because I am going to get triggered. So you have to be up for doing that work if you're going to work with a community that isn't yours. I think that's true of everybody.
Now, you earlier implied that there's sort of I'll use the word backlash. You didn't use that word, but I'll use it. Okay. Against this idea of opening ourselves up and doing these deep dives as a society. And I think there's been this backlash. It occurred to me as you were just talking that I wonder if some of that is a reaction to the anxiety, the distress of facing maybe not what I as an individual may have contributed, but I as a member of a society, of a culture, may have contributed to the BIPOC, as you put it, the sort of the traumatic, the systemic. Let's call it systemic racism. And I wonder if some of this backlash is a sort of an avoidance of the distress of facing that ourselves.
I think it absolutely is. I think it's on a couple of levels, and it's been in the BIPOC community. It has been discussed for a long time. Frances Cress Welsing, who taught at Harvard University, she wrote the ISIS papers, and she discussed the fear of genetic annihilation, which is surely showing its head now. You hear people screaming, "You will not replace us." You know, that's what it is. Right. And I think that the repression or the suppression of very essential information is born out of fear and guilt. And that needs to be processed because I know I don't hold you responsible for something that happened 400 years ago. But to deny that it happened or minimize what happened is really damaging in a lot of ways. One, it curtails your ability to understand the people that you're working with. And it curtails your ability to appreciate their fortitude to survive that. So I think all of that, the book burning, the banning of DEI, all of that is born out of fear.
So as therapists, one might think that we would be a little bit more, be sort of at least open to the idea that we are kind of trying to avoid our own distress and that we need to work through that. One of the things I struggle with in this issue is how to get that message across in a way that doesn't seem blaming, because blaming to me, whether it's justified or not, to me, it seems like that increases the distress and therefore the avoidance.
It's interesting because when people ask me what my religion is, I tell them my religion is love. And then I spent 5 hours yesterday reviewing IFS training.
Internal family systems.
Internal family systems. We're looking at trauma and love being the path to healing. So I think if people as therapists should be able to look inside themselves and find the love, the same way we look at parts and observe it, and have compassion for the wounded, that we can find love for them. And I think once we open up that space with love and compassion, we can transcend the fear, because the fear is intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
And the medicine is emotional, it's heart. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. It makes me, well, the idea of compassion and self, both compassion for self and compassion for other, to allow for those hard feelings. Because I think you're saying that we need to feel those hard feelings in order to make that connection, and to, we need to get through them.
Right.
And exactly. Whatever that means. And I guess as therapists, I feel like we have some demand that we do it. We do the work. We should do the work, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, there's also sometimes the fear of being wrong, that if I own the truth, even if I didn't have a part in it, if I allow it to continue, then I'm complicit. And it takes courage to stand up to injustice. And that's what it has to be. In owning it, I don't have to take responsibility as the creator or the proximate cause of the issue. But I also have to, as a human being, acknowledge the atrocity, the injury to humanity. And if we look at it through as humanity rather than this group of people or this group of people, those groups of people are all human beings. And if we are committed to doing no harm, then we need to stop the harm that's being perpetrated on these people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right now we can take your pick. There's wars popping off all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And not only are we watching them, but we're complicit in participating in them.
We don't even have to go that far. We can just look at healthcare.
Right.
Right. And we know that there are cultural disparities built into the healthcare system. And the question is, what can we, you know, we do no harm. We have all made that our basic oath, so to speak, our basic promise. And how can we, even within our small communities, at every level, we can look at the small communities, we can look at the people around us, we can look at the institutions, we can look at, you know, we can get higher up into levels of society and culture and the geopolitical realm.
Right.
So how can we, this is a rhetorical question, I'm not asking you to necessarily answer it, but how can we as therapists, I guess the question we should ask ourselves, how can we be aware of our own biases, allow ourselves the space, whatever that means, to feel the related feelings, get through that in order to better connect with and better provide better care at a very simple level, to provide better care to the communities and our patients who aren't receiving it.
Exactly. And there's been a tremendous amount of research about that.
Mm-hmm.
JAMA published an article. I think it's important to also examine the assumptions that are made in the BIPOC community, some of them being historical. Again, saying it's really important to know the history. I mean, the belief that is carried into today, into the medical model, that Black people don't feel pain, in particular, mm-hmm. Black women don't feel pain, that Black women are not prescribed pain medication because it's assumed that they're going to abuse the drug. These kinds of things, they're really painful. And as a therapist, I think no matter what color you are, what gender you are, when somebody is being hurt like that, there needs to be the openness in you to be able to empathize and have compassion for that hurt.
Yes, I do a lot of work with chronic pain, mm-hmm. and I'm very, you know, familiar with the research and have seen it. I have seen mm-hmm. it play out in real life, and trying to work within that system and trying to get my patients what they need is hard enough. And then absolutely add this clear bias, and it just trying to work with that within the system and get patients what they need it's really a huge challenge.
And also looking at a system, I came up with the term trauma stupid. I've worked with clients trying to advocate for them, and many times if the person is experiencing emotional abuse, getting help for that client in the social system, unless you see broken bones, bruises, emaciation, hospitalization, trauma is not recognized. So I think trauma education really needs to be pushed forward, because in these days and times, who hasn't experienced trauma? And the blame game comes up with trauma, that we have expectations of traumatized people that are not reasonable. We constantly tell people who are angry to think, well, how do you do that if your prefrontal cortex is offline?
Right.
And the people working with them need to understand that, to find a way to work effectively, to find a different pathway. So I think, yeah, it's not just history. It is understanding the mechanism of the wound that you're dealing with. That we know that ACEs increase the probability of disease. And then repeatedly I hear the assignment of responsibility, these people who have the diseases, to go to the doctor. Well, let's look at that. Going to the doctor can be a very frustrating experience. In the BIPOC community, it's really hard to get people to go to the doctor because of the lack of respect, trust, safety. And there's a lot of history that goes through that. So that simple little thing that might be easy for you with insurance and your demographic is mm-hmm. going to be very different for somebody with maybe the same income, profession, but different skin color. You will get treated differently. I think it's important for somebody, a therapist, to appreciate that, because all too often the client is judged for not behaving like the therapist would.
And I can remember early on in my training working with people who were from very different cultural backgrounds and feeling so lost and mm-hmm. thinking, why aren't they responding the way they're supposed to? And clearly, you know, it was my limitations, because you're right. I know I could go to a doctor and I will be treated differently than if you went to the same doctor with the same complaint. And as clinicians, as therapists, we should be struggling. I agree. I think we should be struggling with this. And I think you're making some really important and I think useful suggestions. The work is hard and we need to do it.
Mm-hmm. But there are people like myself who have been working on this work for a while now. So I think it becomes important to know about me and others like me who have published works. I mean, there are resources to make it easier to do this deep dive. I will provide links and references in my presentation. And I'm trying very hard to put more BIPOC therapists out there.
Join me for the second half of my discussion with Mayla Berger on the next episode of Healthy Brain, Happy Body. And definitely join NRBS for her webinar on May 2nd. You can register in the show notes or at nrbs.org. Subscribe to this podcast by clicking the subscribe here link or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy it, please subscribe, rate us, and leave reviews at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Reviews help us get to more listeners, and that's more people who can learn about and benefit from biofeedback, neurofeedback, and other mind-body approaches to health. Also, let us know what you think by sending us email. Our address is healthybrain@nrbs.org. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is produced and edited by me. The theme music is Catch It by Coma Media. It's a production of the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. Go to nrbs.org to find out more about the organization, including our trainings, monthly webinars, and yearly conference. All opinions expressed are those of our guests and not the NRBS. This podcast is not meant to replace advice from qualified healthcare providers. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is supported by the sponsors of NRBS and by the International Society for Neuroregulation and Research. Be sure to join us at our next episode as we continue to explore the keys to our well-being on Healthy Brain, Happy Body.